Welcome to Oncology Today, key papers and presentations from the March 2022 Society of Gynecologic Annual Meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. David O'Malley from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. In addition to this audio podcast, there is also a corresponding video program with Dr. O'Malley's slide presentation. To begin, Dr. O'Malley commented on one of the key presentations from the meeting. We can start with the mirvetuximab and the Soroya study. Can you talk a little bit about what that study looked at, what they saw there, and what you think it means in terms of future patient care and also future research?
So the Soroya data really looked at with 1 to 3 prior therapies for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, and all the patients had to have had Bev. So it's a patient population outside of our indication for Bev in the United States in the platinum-resistant population. So what we took was those patients who received prior Bev, platinum-resistant, single-agent mirvetuximab, and had a 34% response rate with a DOR almost 7 months. So the duration response typically, historically, would expect about 4 months, plus or minus. So you're looking at a 50% increase, if not higher, in the expected duration of response. And so we believe this will lead to the accelerated approval of mirvetuximab being available for our patients at the time that the confirmatory phase 3 MIRASOL trial is completing. I've always said with mirvetuximab's payload being an antimicrobial tubulin, that my hope is it will replace paclitaxel as we move forward in those patients who have tumors that express high folate receptor. And you could really argue medium in the future, but that's a discussion for a different day. So when we look at the development and the opportunities for MIRV, what I'm really looking for is how do I get it into my patients sooner? So MIRV plus Bev, MIRV plus Carbo, potentially the triplet, MIRV, Carbo, Bev. These are the way that we're looking to treat patients from platinum resistant, then moving into platinum sensitive, and then potentially frontline therapy.
So can you talk a little bit about how MIRV works and what fraction of patients are potentially eligible to receive it in terms of biomarkers?
So high folate receptor alpha is right about 40% plus or minus high expressors. 90% of high-grade ovarian cancer, about 90%, will express folate receptor alpha. But we believe those that are the highest expressors are those that respond the best. So about 40% of the population will be high folate receptor alpha expressors. About another 30% will be medium, then the rest low, and again, about 90% will have some expression. But the high will have the best response, but we see wonderful response in medium, particularly when we combine it with Bev or other cytotoxics.
And what have we seen in the past in terms of tolerability, particularly related to the eye, and what was seen reported by Dr. Matalonis at the recent presentation of the data of the Soroya study?
So the eye toxicity, particularly in GYN cancer patients, where we're not used to eye toxicity, right? But those who give antibody drug conjugates and other solid tumors are probably thinking this is no big deal. So when we look at the occurrence, about a third of the patients will have some eye toxicity. Now, keratopathies actually, when you see microcyst on the examination of the cornea, but they may not even have symptoms, but as you saw in that diagram, that most patients who have blurred vision will have keratopathy and the other way around. But when you look at the discontinuation rate, only about 1% of patients been treated with MIRV have discontinued because of the eye toxicity. So though it is a side effect, the mitigation strategies in our management rarely lead to discontinuation of the agent.
So it's interesting. We do see a lot of eye issues, particularly with antibody drug conjugates and solid tumors. And it kind of sounds like more of a problem than you're describing. Also, it seems like more of a problem than I hear about with tisotumab vedotin, or you tell me. Are eye issues more there?
Well, it's interesting because they're very different eye toxicity. With TV, when they have eye toxicity, you see it. They look like that pink eye. They come in, it's irritating. It's not subtle, usually. Now, there's been some reports of keratopathies, even one report of blindness and corneal abrasion. But really, the eye toxicity is quite different. And so it's very predictable in MERV. It's about day 7 to 10 on cycle 2. And we warn patients, we say it's going to happen. And if it gets into where it's bothersome, we will hold the dose and reintroduce at a lower dose. So that's why it's such a low discontinuation rate. But again, some of the same mitigation strategies that were used in TV, we also use with MERV.
If MERV were available right now, would you use it in your practice and in what situations?
Oh, I would use it in a heartbeat. I mean, we're really, really itching to have access of this for MERV for our patients. Again, unfortunately, we've learned some hard lessons that when you go against chemotherapy, you should only include those that have the highest response rate, the high folate receptors. And that's why Forward One was negative, as well as other reasons. So absolutely would utilize it. I would utilize it in the indication, which would be platinum resistant, but look for opportunities to move it earlier on in the line of therapy. Remember, you don't have alopecia, decrease incidence of neuropathy. This is a really wonderful drug that I look forward to utilizing for our patients in the future.
Just a few months ago at the ASH meeting, we saw in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma for the first time, I think, since rituximab, phase 3 study that was positive using an antibody drug conjugate substituting for vincristine. This was polatuzumab. Where do you see MERV heading? I know there's a bunch of trials. You mentioned combinations, but ultimately, you hear in bladder cancer, they talk about enfortumab plus IO first line. Any fantasies about where MERV is going to land in the next few years?
I think we'll start with platinum resistant with the information which is available, adding it to Bev, which many of us, weekly paclitaxel plus Bev is our really go-to when we need a response. But obviously the alopecia and the neuropathy is challenging. You'll see it as a single agent platinum resistant. You'll see it combined with Bev with now several hundred patients or a couple hundred patients treated with that combination as reported in the literature. And then you'll see it start to migrate earlier on in patients if the design of the maintenance therapy with platinum sensitive, and you'll see it utilized with platinum sensitive disease as we move forward. Hopefully, Gloriosa will be positive. And as the PI of that study, I have a lot of investment, obviously.
So I'm calling the fall of 2021 the fall of the ADCs because we've seen so many really impressive papers. I mentioned diffuse large B cell and breast cancer. We saw one ADC beat another ADC in HER2 positive disease. But hearing about all these, you know, myelomas, got belantamab, another eye thing, all of a sudden you got another ADC, UpRi, which looks pretty interesting. So what is this?
So UpRi is against NaPi2b. Again, we're looking at a different scoring system now using TPS instead of the 2+ scoring system. But we're identifying patients who, again, are going to benefit by patients with a molecular target, NaPi2b, again, expressed in about 2/3 of patients. When we look at the high expressors, it's about half of the patients, okay? And again, an active antimicrotubulin payload. Now, what we don't know is the overlap of high folate receptor alpha and NaPi2b. So I envision in the future both of these drugs being available to us, and we'll test all of our patients for those expressions. Again, looking at response rates of 44%, we know in early phase trials, it's always a little bit higher than we see in the phase 3 trials, but a 44% response rate is pretty impressive. Clearly, we continue to have work on the toxicity and the dosing, which now has been solidified at 36 milligrams per meter squared. And we will continue to improve and gain experience about how to give UpRi in the future as we get more experience with the agent.
What's the target here? Does it have any sort of particular meaning biologically, or is it just some target?
It's interesting that sodium channels, we don't really know why that would be expressed in cancer. At least I don't. Actually, I looked this up because, Neil, you always ask me a question that I don't know the answer to. And I figured this would be one of them. and you always get me. And this one, I was like, okay, I don't know this time, but I'm not sure anybody knows. So I got that. So
wow, that is really interesting. One other thing about antibody drug conjugates, and again, this came up with T-DXd and HER2 positive breast cancer, but I don't know if it might extend beyond it because I didn't hear about it with the other ones, is a so-called bystander effect. Actually, there's a paper about a positive trial of HER2 low breast cancer, which is not supposed to. And you mentioned, for example, these targets, the low, high, et cetera. Any possibility that any of these are going to have a bystander effect?
Well, we hope so. But I think the bystander effect with MIRV may not be as high as we'd like. And maybe that's why we need that high folate receptor alpha expressor. But maybe it has nothing to do with the bystander effect. And it just has to do with the amount of drug that you can get into the cancer. So the NaPi2b UpRi agent, what's really interesting is that drug, when it's taken up, is not active. So you have less bystander effect for the non-malignant cells, right? So you actually are minimizing bystander effect. Now, that's good for potential toxicity, but could that be a detriment to the other non-NaPi2b expressing cells? But when you then, as it's taken up, it becomes active, it gets unlocked, and then you release the active payload into the surrounding microenvironment and into the surrounding tissue. So there seems to be that there'd have to be some bystander effect, but it's very important. As you talk about the HER2 new, 1+ looking potentially as a positive. So over time, we're going to have to figure this out more. And is bystander effect a good thing or a bad thing or a little bit of both? I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah, it's a good point about the chemo effects in terms of toxicity, because in fact, we do hear in breast cancer, alopecia, nausea, et cetera, with T-DXd. So like you say, both sides. Curious about your thoughts about Tumor Treating Fields. You mentioned its use in other cancers. I can remember we used to go to the SNO meeting, Society of Neuro-Oncology, and all of a sudden I started to see stuff on Tumor Treating Fields. We actually had a speaker cover it, and I thought it was really interesting, although, as you say, it seems very different anyhow. But here we go, SGO, there it is. You see a paper on it. Can you talk a little bit about what they presented and what it is to start with?
It's an electric field. And I was talking to this to one of the GY oncologists, and she said, our entire body is made up of electrolytes. I mean, it makes so much sense. You're aligning. So the Tumor Treating Fields actually are also another anti-microtubulant. So it's affecting the mitotic spindle at the tubulin level. So you have a similar disruption to paclitaxel. And that's one reason we think that it works better with paclitaxel. But now you have an antimicrotubulin that's well-tolerated, electric fields, plus PARP inhibitor. And we know how difficult it is to combine PARP inhibitors plus cytotoxic because the hematologic toxicity as well as some GI toxicity. But now we don't have a cytotoxic therapy, not even a biologic agent, but electric field. And so we suspect we can get the Tumor Treating Fields in with PARP inhibitors. And again, this was what was reported as SGO was the preclinical work. But in a BRCA wild type population, we saw synergistic cell killing, right? And additive in a BRCA mutant cell line. So could we improve upon the benefits of PARP inhibitors with a microtubulin agent, but one that's well tolerated? Now, the challenge is when we did Innovate 3, the recommendations are 18 hours of 24 that you have the Tumor Treating Fields on. And so you're using these arrays and you have some challenges to skin toxicity and wearing these arrays. If you're utilizing it for maintenance therapies, we have to be very purposeful in how could we do that so the impact on the quality of life wouldn't be so high to have 18 hours of these Tumor Treating Fields and arrays.
So is it like a vest? I know in mesothelioma, it sort of covers the whole chest. We had a case of a patient with morbid obesity, didn't know if they could get the thing on or whatever. Put this thing around the abdomen?
So because it's electric field, you need to oppose. So you have two arrays, and you actually have two sets of arrays. So you have four arrays, and you set them at where your disease burden is. Now, they're in the process. They just actually had approval for the next generation of generator, which will be lighter. But the arrays kind of look like plastic little small suction cups. They're not suction cups. They're electric cup. But they sit right there.
It's like an EKG cup?
It's like it looks like a series of EKG leads that are on a cloth bandage. And so you have that. You have a big one and a small one. For most patients are able to get very good coverage over the abdominal and pelvic area. They are in the process of designing an even larger one because we have patients who have chest disease and abdominal and pelvic disease. And so we want to extend the coverage more. And that would make a lot of sense as we move forward.
So you've had patients receive this therapy?
Yeah, we're one of the largest accruers in the country for the clinical trial.
I'm really curious to see what the patients are saying to you.
So the patients love the idea of this non-chemotherapy. So they really like it. Now, it is challenging at times because you have to wear a small backpack. You have to have this thing with you. You know, if you're using it while you're sleeping, but that only is taking whatever, 6, 8, 10, 12 hours. And you can wear it underneath the arrays. You can wear underneath clothes. Nobody would even know you have the arrays on, but you have the generator with you. Now, the skin irritation, because there is some local impact, you have a bit of a, potentially some people develop a little dermatitis if you imagine wearing a Band-Aid for 18 hours a day. So the quality and impact on patients can be there, particularly with dermatologic manifestations. But patients really like the idea of this kind of alternative therapy and messing with the electric fields with the cancer. They really respond to that as a potential mechanism of action.
Any anecdotal observations that encourages you?
Well, you know, really what caused me to say this is going to work was when the thoracic mesothelioma indication came forward, saying because previously with just being the GBM, I was like, okay, it's a very hard disease to treat, but very well-defined treatment fields. While the abdominal pelvic area, much different to treat, similar to the thorax. So again, it was an open label study. There was no sham arrays. So I knew who was getting therapy. I have a lot of confidence in this technology. Ultimately, that's why we do large randomized phase 3 trials. We'll have to wait and see across. But as I said, we're one of the largest enrollers in the United States on the trial.
So understanding the observational nature of this, I mean, the bottom line is, have you seen any cases where you saw responses that really just, nobody's getting it by themselves alone. It's not single agent.
Right.
So you have that old story.
Right.
But sometimes you see things and you go, well, that can't be. So you tell me, have you seen any cases that made you think that, hey, something's going on?
Yeah, as I said, I'm very excited that this is going to add a lot to weekly paclitaxel.
So let me ask you another question. I mean, I'm sure you looked at the data in GBM and mesothelioma. In addition to the fact they're approved, when you actually look at the data itself, do you feel convinced there's a benefit?
Well, in GBM, we have larger randomized trials. There's clearly benefit. It's survival benefit. Now, GBM, again, is a pretty hard to treat disease, much better options than there was not that long ago. The mesothelioma is actually a single arm trial. So it was not a large randomized trial. And so because of that, to me, am I saying this is a slam dunk? This is going to be a positive phase 3 trial. I'm definitely not saying that. But looking at the experience, looking at the preclinical work, looking at what I've seen, I believe that there's a very good chance that this will show additional benefit over weekly paclitaxel by itself. Now, again, weekly paclitaxel by itself is a very good regimen. And so being able to differentiate that to what the rest of the patients are doing who are only getting the weekly paclitaxel, that's what keeps me up at night because that's what I worry about.
Well, in any event, I'm just encouraged to hear you respond, because almost everybody I ask about it says they don't know. So at least you have some experience, yeah. And I'm impressed, really, honestly. Yeah. All right, well, let's get down to some of the more nitty-gritty. Of course, everybody wants to hear about all the PARP papers. So let's go through some of them. I don't know if I saw anything exactly practice-changing, but there's certainly a lot of interesting stuff. And some of it relates to who responds. You mentioned this paper initially by Liz Swisher et al. And I honestly, I'm not sure I understand all the biology. So you want to take another shot at sort of explaining what she saw there?
So we're trying to identify patients who are going to respond that we can identify that we absolutely should use PARP mains on. So right now we know BRCA patients. You could argue with the work that we did through Ariel 2 and 3, RAD51 CRD. Without debate, those patients need a PARP and they need a PARP in the first line therapy. The HRD patients, who again, the Myriad test is one of the tests we use, the LOH test, they now call HRD, Foundation Medicine, Tempus, all of these diagnostic tests are trying to really identify patients who are going to respond better to PARP inhibitors. They can say whatever they want to say, but that's really the question. So what Liz did is she took in patients not who had received PARP, but who had ovarian cancer, who had received therapy, not received therapy, and she had these tissues. And she looked at the methylation on the RAD51C or BRCA. And what methylation is an acquired change in the promoter region, so it makes RAD51C or BRCA non-functional, essentially an acquired BRCA or RAD51 mutation, but not germline acquired. So it makes sense that patients who had more therapy had a higher chance of having this methylated change. And so she's trying to identify patients who will have a better chance to respond to PARP inhibitors and a better quantitative test. And that really was what the report was on. We're identifying these tests. From that standpoint, we went to identify non-BRCA patients, BRCA wild type, to see who would respond, who would have a better chance to respond to PARP inhibitors.
I've heard it said that these assays, I guess my primitive understanding is, I guess they're looking at some kind of mutations, but they're looking at scarring or something. What are they actually measuring?
Well, the methylated actually can be done quantitatively, and I am not going to do Liz Swisher injustice of trying to explain that. But when you look at the scarring, the loss of heterozygosity, which was measured, for example, in the Foundation Medicine, you're looking at acquired scarring. You're exactly right. Scarring within that along the genome. And with that acquired scarring, you have this acquired dysfunction. And for that, we then think that the PARP inhibitors are going to be more effective. And again, this is not a direct measure. It's an indirect. And still, we have so many opportunities to improve the technology, improve the diagnostic testing, to find those patients who are going to better respond.
How do you define scarring? Again, are they measuring mutations? What are they measuring? Mutations?
It's not alter mutated. Again, I don't think I can do it justice, and I should have known you'd ask That's me that okay. question. I got two of the three. I didn't get the third one.
You're one of the few people who can explain the biology and pathways in a way I can understand. Let's flip from the theoretical to the practical. This other paper you talked about from SGO from Katie Moore, one quote, real world treatment patterns. I always kind of wonder whether that really is what's happening in the real world, or maybe I'm talking to people who are different than the real world. I don't know, but they always come up with stuff that supposedly is not getting done. Is that your take? I mean, do you think that there are people, a lot of people not getting genomic assays when they walk through the door with ovarian cancer, really?
Well, you ask a great question, which is how real world are these, right? You're asking oncologists, you're giving them a small stipend to go and look at 10 of their charts and then report it. So you don't have the quality assurance in those. And so you're just counting on people to be truthful in what they're doing. But what was very interesting, why I like this, and I've done some real world data and claims and looking at toxicities and such. So you always have to take this with a grain of salt, but I thought it was very well designed. I should expect nothing less from Katie Moore. Anything she's involved in is brilliant. But they looked at three cohorts over time that really made sense. And I think the graphic that I put up, which to me caused me to be more confident in this data, was the utilization of first-line maintenance treatment overall across all three cohorts going up very consistent in a linear fashion. So for me, that gave me confidence that this data is as accurate as any of this data could be. It's kind of like retrospective, right? You have to take it with a grain of salt. But it was really interesting to say, over time, we've had more agents, we've had more studies, phase three studies, that have shown maintenance therapy is to be utilized to improve our outcomes for our patients. But yet, when I talk to patients around the country and really around the world, I would think that around 30 to 40% continue not to use maintenance therapy. Many of those in HRP patients or HRD negative patients. So when I looked at the numbers and I looked at as I talked to people around the world, I said, you know what? This is pretty believable. And the linear association was also believable. So again, not perfect data, but it really gives us an opportunity to see and learn more. And the other thing with regards to genetic testing, 17% of patients not getting genetic testing. Not that long ago, it was 80%. So yes, we have an opportunity there, but it is much better. But nobody wants to fill out one of these surveys and said, I didn't get genetic testing on an advanced stage ovarian cancer patient. So if they said 17%, it's probably higher than that because everybody knows you need to genetic test on ovarian cancer patient.
So another paper you talked about that I was very interested in because of a previous paper in breast cancer called NEOTALA, looking at neoadjuvant use of telazoparib in breast cancer, where shockingly in BRCA patients, it was only 100 patients, but they had 50% past CR, which everybody was stunned at. And then I was like, well, what about ovary? And of course, I know Shannon Weston's done a lot of work, but you put up this paper there on niraparib as neoadjuvant therapy. What about that paper? Have you seen something like that before, incidentally?
Well, not much. This is probably the first report with single agent PARP. And again, Shannon and her group at MD Anderson have done a really nice job of looking at some of this. And I'm trying to think what she's reported thus far. And again, she does a lot with combination ATR inhibitors and such. So when we looked at this, again, very small report, very, very small report. But when I start seeing 6 of 8 patients getting a partial response and after just 2 cycles, it really shows that we can do these trials and that maybe we should be not just from a experimental to look at the biopsies, but also to give patients potentially a non-chemotherapy option in that first line setting.
Well, also, what a great window of opportunity to look at the biology and before and after and try to really start to dig into why do some people respond and some people don't. So I think it's fantastic.
I've advocated for and have thus not been successful, but continue to advocate for this trial. It did just 2 months. So you're minimizing risk to patients. You have an active therapy. You're watching them very closely. I would advocate to actually do 4 months of therapy where you have the first scan, making sure that you're not hurting the patient by responding, and then confirming that response after 4 months. Neoadjuvant chemotherapy in ovarian cancer, 3 to 4 cycles is considered within the standards of care. And so window of opportunities, identifying potentially resistant mechanisms, identify new agents. How nice would it be if in ovarian cancer, we could identify response rates in the neoadjuvant patients like they have pathologic CR in breast cancer for a new way to get drugs approved in a faster, more timely fashion rather than waiting 3 and 5 years for the outcomes of large phase 3 trials and maintenance strategy, for example.
And speaking of breast cancer, the next thing I was going to ask you is, you know, in a way, you know, I always see these weird things, but it kind of reminds me of hormonal therapy and chemotherapy and breast cancer. And there, they have this strategy in ER-positive people where they give neoadjuvant hormones and measure before and after Ki-67. And if the Ki-67 drops, they know they're going in the right direction. So that's another way to look at it a little bit more dynamically.
Anyway, I've always loved neoadjuvant. It actually didn't go as far as I thought it was going to go, but who knows? Maybe it will in the future. Another topic that I think is very interesting, and you mentioned it came up, is the issue of PARP plus Bev. And of course, we saw the practice-changing Paola study with olaparib. And it seems like I keep seeing data looking at niraparib, but not randomized. And you talked about the phase two ovario study with niraparib and Bev. Any thoughts about that? And where do you see niraparib plus Bev heading, if anywhere?
It's tough when you have a phase three trial and you're trying to say the single arm trial looks just as good as the phase two trial. And so for people who really want to use niraparib, I think this provides some justification to say, okay, it's a reasonable option. You know, the problem with niraparib is the hypertension is a rare but potentially serious, and obviously worry about from Bev, and combining the Bev plus niraparib offers a little bit more of a challenge. We know that niraparib's hematologic toxicity is a concern, and that doesn't really impact when you're utilizing it with Bev. But I do worry about some of the cardiac toxicity as well as hypertension. We haven't seen the cardiac toxicity, but something to, again, if somebody said to me, I'm not going to use olaparib, I'm going to use niraparib plus Bev, with ovario, I think it's a reasonable option, okay? But again, I'm going to put more weight into the phase three randomized trial than a single arm phase two. But again, data, high-risk population, outcomes which are similar to what's been reported. Obviously, we never do cross-trial comparison, right?
Never.
But
you mean
but again, I think this provides some justification for those who are going to want to use niraparib plus Bev. Though, again, I would fall back to the phase three, Bev plus olaparib.
Well, I know where people want to use niraparib and not necessarily olaparib, and that's BRCA wild type. But will you tell me, what do you think about those patients getting niraparib plus Bev?
I tell you, I really believe at this point, it used to be, should we use maintenance therapy? And this is a little bit of the getting more real-world data that we discussed. In my mind, when Paola 1 came out with regards to Bev versus Bev plus olaparib, it no longer was, should we use it, but which maintenance therapy should we use? And to have a patient, to have an ovarian cancer patient be considered low risk, who has advanced stage ovarian cancer, if that's my loved one and you tell me she has an 80 to 85% chance of recurring, I want to make sure that if I have a well-tolerated regimen, that I'm going to try to keep that cancer away as long as possible. Why else? Every patient-reported outcome, twist analysis, if you keep the cancer away, you have better quality of life. So for me, when we look at patient population, if you say to me, okay, Dave, I'm going to use Bev rather than niraparib for my HRP patients, I can't argue it. But use one or the other. Use that maintenance strategy. And you know I'm drinking the Kool-Aid with maintenance therapy as a disclaimer, but I do believe it's the right thing for our patients.
So actually, I don't know if you're aware, but there are two papers presented using PARP in patients first-line metastatic disease, castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So they had one trial with olaparib and one with niraparib. Guess which one had benefit with the wild type and the other one didn't?
Oh, I don't know this. This is interesting.
Oh, you don't know it?
You got me.
Guess what? Flip. It was positive for olaparib and not for niraparib.
For niraparib. Interesting.
And of course, they have no idea what to do with that. We're telling them, why don't you go look at the ovary trials, whatever. But Just saying, maybe PARP inhibitors aren't as different as we thought because it's completely flipped in prostate. Different disease.
And what else did we just see? We just saw the Athena data and press release. So the Athena data from press release is also positive for monotherapy rucaparib in the first line setting. So we haven't seen, but they actually released more in that press release than really any press release I've seen before. And so clearly the intent to treat population, positive subpopulations are positive. So we're looking forward to seeing that data at a Congress shortly. And we'll have more to talk about because we may have a second agent in that all-comer population to discuss.
I'm not sure, though, looking at that press release, whether you could tease out the BRCA wild type by itself. It had the overall, but did you see BRCA wild type alone?
No, you can't tease that out from the press release, but I can tell you the Congress coming up, that we'll talk a lot more about all those subgroups.
Wow, that's interesting. So another trial I'm curious about is this PRIME study, phase 3 study of niraparib as maintenance. How's that different from PRIMA?
So the difference between PRIME and PRIMA, PRIMA was a higher risk population, meaning neoadjuvant chemotherapy, stage 4, or residual disease at the end of their primary therapy. While PRIME study allowed all comers to come into the trial, 2-to-1 randomization, essentially the same as PRIMA, except all comers and Chinese only. This is the same population that Athena was, but obviously different countries.
So any specific grain of salt about ovarian cancer, PARP inhibitors, and Asian population? Anything in particular? Pharmacokinetics? What are you thinking?
Well, I don't think we have to that granularity at this point. But the only population where we've seen dose-dense weekly paclitaxel beat every 3-week paclitaxel was in Japanese patients. So there is some data with regards to clearance. Now, I cannot quote anything from PARP inhibitors, and I'm not sure that work's been done extensively. I know it's been done somewhat. So there may be a difference in biology of the tumor. There's going to be more clear cell, though I don't believe clear cell was enrolled into the PRIME study. Okay. And there is going to be difference in potentially tolerance based on pharmacokinetics. But I do think it adds to the breadth of literature, particularly in the lower risk population, similar to Athena.
Did they use the platelet weight dose adjustment in this?
Yes, they did use the individual starting dose. Correct.
Well, when you started talking about the PRIMA study and PRIME, I immediately was looking for the same exact thing we were just talking about, was what happened in the BRCA wild type. I don't know if I read this right. It worked, right?
Correct. It did. And not only did it work in the BRCA wild type, but the BRCA wild type, when they broke down the HRD and the HRP, the actual magnitude of benefit, the hazard ratio was 0.41 in the BRCA wild type HRP. When we looked at the HRD population, the hazard ratio is 0.58. So again, the control arm in the HRP does a lot worse. And though the medians will be different, the benefit will be greater. So when we look at the median progression-free survival in the BRCA wild-type HRD, it was 24.8 versus 11.1 months. What's interesting in the HRP BRCA wild-type, the placebo, the control arm, was 5.5. Very consistent with PRIMA. In the experimental arm, the niraparib arm was 14 months. So almost threefold improvement in that patient population. And so the placebo arm, the historical control, what behaved very similarly, but you saw greater benefit in the niraparib arm.
I'm just saying that because I think maybe a lot of people question whether really there, although the hazard rate with PRIMA was like 0.5 or something in those patients, but still people questioned it. It still seems consistent that it has what we're calling BRCA wild type response.
Well, and what's interesting is this comes back to the molecular testing question that we asked earlier, the methylation question. What are the patients? We know about a third of patients above and beyond this other group that are going to do well for other reasons, about a third of HR deficient testing negative patients that will have marked improvement in their outcomes with PARP inhibitors. So this supports that you are getting those patients into longer disease-free survival or progression-free survival.
Let's talk about a couple of olaparib papers that were presented at SGO, starting out with MONO-OLA-1, randomized phase 3 of olaparib maintenance monotherapy in BRCA wild-type advanced ovarian cancer. What were they looking at there?
So this is interesting. So This is, again, ex-US, really ex-Western European countries. So different countries, as well as Latin America, patient population. And what they're doing is looking at BRCA wild-type patients in a 2-to-1 randomization, olaparib versus placebo. So these patients, in SOLO-1, we had to have patients with a BRCA mutation. We know almost all of those were germline. There's a few that were somatic. The POLO-1 data, you had the BEV maintenance arm and olaparib BEV, but what was the missing arm? Single agent olaparib. And a lot of people have said, if you would have had a single agent olaparib arm, you wouldn't have beat olaparib BEV. Now, we don't know that, obviously. So this is really that missing arm and missing comparison in POLO-1 and a different population is SOLO-1. Again, much different countries that have been studied in those other trials. But this trial will add to our understanding of the single agent olaparib in patients who are BRCA wild type. And when we look at those progression-free survivals across all of the subgroups.
How about the follow-up from SOLO-3 presented by Dr. Penson, another olaparib trial? The other ones have been around a while.
This was a little disappointing. This was the comparison of platinum-sensitive patients who are BRCA mutated, comparing olaparib versus physician choice chemotherapy, but did not allow platinum as one of the choices in the treatment decisions. The trial itself had some challenges. Its overall design, not having platinum in the standard of care as a choice, and now in the final overall survival analysis with such high dropout rate. Unfortunately, the dropout rate of a quarter of the chemotherapy arm for prior to death is really potentially impacts the outcomes here. So only 11% of the olaparib patients withdrew consent, but 25% of the chemotherapy. And when you look at the tails of these curves in the survival, it's just the opposite of what you would potentially expect with having such marked improvement in the original progression-free survival reports. So how much is that impacted by the doubling, more than doubling of the dropout rate versus is there something where we should be using olaparib earlier rather than waiting for this platinum sensitive recurrence and not using platinum agents? So it was a little disappointing on multiple levels. The take home point for me is that you don't see a detriment to the overall survival in these patients with BRCA mutated platinum sensitive relapse if you utilize olaparib. The progression free survival 2 mirrors exactly what we'd expect when compared to the original progression free survival improvement with the olaparib patients. But it was surprising and maybe a bit disappointing we had that many patients drop off, which may have influenced the tails of those curves.
Did they report MDS-AML?
They did. It was very consistent with the original reports. It was about 3.5% in these patients versus, I think it's about 2% in the cytotoxic arm.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. O'Malley, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Nia Love for Oncology Today.